The work of suffragettes in both the United Kingdom and in the United States has been immortalized in textbooks, as well as in movies and TV. The women activists who helped women gain the right to vote are often portrayed as heroes and radicals. What's gotten less attention is the connection between the statistical world and the suffragette movement. That's a focus of this episode of Stats and Stories, where we explore the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics. I'm Rosemary Pennington. Stats and Stories is a production of Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film, as well as the American Statistical Association. Joining me is regular panelist John Baylor, Emeritus Professor of Statistics at Miami University. Our guest today is Altea Lorenzo Arribas. Lorenzo Arribas is a socioeconomic statistician at Biomathematics and Statistics Scotland, an elected member of the Royal Statistical Society Council, and secretary of the RSS History of Statistics section. She was one of the guest editors of the Significance Magazine October 2022 special issue on women in statistics and data science. Lorenzo Arribas has also authored pieces for both Chance and Significance about the connection between statistics and the movement for women's suffrage. Altea, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you both for having me. It's an honor to speak to you.
How did you get interested in this connection between stats and suffrage?
Well, I first became connected to the world of history of stats and history of women in stats through Florence Nightingale, because I didn't feel represented in the field that I was studying. So I was always interested in seeing beyond the names and the theorems that we were studying. They all felt like very far from my world. So I became interested in Florence Nightingale, which took me to the RSS Bicentenary Committee, trying to organize the celebration to celebrate 200 years since her birth. And then through there, I started to study more women in the past of the discipline and trying to understand how they changed the discipline and how they advanced it. And through this, which actually happened to coincide with my two maternity leaves, then I got to the work of these suffragists that were elected fellows of the society. And I was just very interested to see that there was so little, both on their work, but also on the suffrage movement as a whole. So there was very little on the statistics around it.
So could you introduce us to Millicent Fawcett and Eleanor Florence Rathbone?
Absolutely. So these two women were the main representatives of the National Unions of the Suffrage Movement, which was the organization that represented the suffragists within the suffrage movement. And they were basically the political side of the suffrage movement. They weren't so involved in the fights that had been more represented in the history of the movement. They were more involved in the actually making the connections through politics, but also through data, to keep the movement going and to be pragmatic about it. They were trying to achieve one step at a time as much progress as possible. But yeah, as I said, it was probably the most pragmatic side of the movement. But they were both the leaders of the union at different stages. So Eleanor Rathbone took the baton from Millicent, but they coexisted through most of their fight, and they actually managed to succeed in 1920 while they were both living and still working together towards it.
Reading through both the Chance piece and the Significance article, I was struck by this idea that women were considered an unknown quantity. And I wondered if you could sort of talk through exactly what people, mostly men, were suggesting when they were saying women were an unknown quantity, and sort of how these two figures might play out in that.
Yes, I actually love that concept that Millicent Fawcett coined herself, actually. I think it was really reflective of the little data that there were in women, not only on their political attitudes, but on all on all the spheres, really, on the workplace. On the, there wasn't very many data on them, and therefore both political parties, all the political parties, fear that they wouldn't necessarily vote for them. So yeah, they were an unknown quantity, but also others in within the Royal Statistical Society recognized that. That there was no enough data, so previous famous names like Clara Collet and Charles Booth have worked on trying to represent women in their social surveys of, for instance, London or big cities. Also, other statisticians like Elizabeth Hutchins have tried to represent the figures and the proportion of women in industry. So this has been work that had started before, but it was very slowly going on. And some of the presidents, including President Dilke of the Society, recognized that their own franchise statistics, there was very little information, very few facts, and therefore all the potential estimates or potential arguments that people had for and against the women's vote were completely unfounded.
You know, when I was reading your articles, I was struck by the some of the policy work related to so kind of the advocacy of equal pay, and then also the initiation of family allowances or child benefits. Could you talk a little bit about those two policies and you know, when did this happen? You know, what years were these things occurring?
Yes, these are things that actually are very interesting, both policies. So on the equal pay, both women, Fawcett and Rathbone, actually didn't completely agree, which was quite interesting. So they both agreed there had to be changes, but Fawcett was more of the thought that the issue had to be with a lack of specialization of women. So she really tried to push it through that, through trying to encourage more education for the women and thinking that was the way to achieve equal pay. And she, in fact, co-founded Newman College in Cambridge in 1875. So this was her main worry. And on the other hand, Rathbone had a greater interest on reflecting the lack of help that there were for women and their caring responsibilities. She thought by default there should be a way to compensate women for the caring work that they were doing that wasn't being paid. And this was even more patent during periods of war where women were at home, there was no money coming from the men's work, and women were completely empty-handed. So that was her argument pro equal pay. So they both, yeah, really advocated, not necessarily agreeing on the terms, but they really went for it. But and Rathbone's fight for the childcare benefit that you mentioned was a continuation of this fight for equal pay, really. And that actually touches is very closer to my heart, because of course this childcare benefit that she achieved in 1945 as one of the first women to be MPs in the British Parliament. It was then called family allowance, but it's now still a working payment, the only universal payment in UK, and it's helping many families like mine to deal with the cost of living crisis and so on. So I'm really very in debt to her. But yeah, see, they both achieved most of their fights before their deaths. And so that was, we are all really, I'm particularly grateful. Yeah, but I think we should all be very grateful for their massive work. Yeah, and regarding equal pay, of course, a more difficult thing to assess as to whether we've achieved it yet, to be honest. So that's probably something to confirm.
As you're talking, it made me think of in the Significance article, you talk about this piece that was published or was going to be published by a man called Are Women Lazy, where Rathbone is sort of saying, I can't respond to this because there are all of these generalizations about women. But some of what, you know, she's describing is the fact that women are doing this work, as you point out, like domestic work that's undervalued. And it makes me think of this conversation we are having now, still in this day about how do you quantify in some way the labor that goes into a home, right? Whether it's a man or a woman staying home, there's still that conversation about there's a lot of labor that a partner at home puts into sort of supporting a household that we still are, that doesn't count in the same ways that work outside the home is counted. It just sort of struck me that this is still a conversation that we're having 100 years later.
Absolutely, yes. And I feel not only that, but also the impact that motherhood or parenthood have in women's careers, particularly, is completely forgotten in any estimations of pay or progression. And I know it's different in the US, but in the UK, you can get extended parental leave, and it's a very common thing to do. So in the case of my two children, I've had over a year of parental leave. And therefore, of course, my CV has been seriously affected by these gaps. And how do you estimate the effect on this, on my career, all the missed opportunities? It's very difficult to estimate. I appreciate it's not a simple task to account for these things, but there more work needs to be done, both on accounting for the caring responsibilities and the impact on our careers. I completely agree.
You're listening to Stats and Stories, and today we're talking with Altea Lorenzo Arribas about suffragettes, statistics, and women in stats.
Another thing that struck me as I was reading your articles was the U.S. Census coming out as an important part of this story, and how the census was leading in some of its hiring practices and its workforce. Could you tell the listeners a little bit about that?
Yes, I wasn't completely surprised when I found it, because I had already seen a lot of the work that the Census Bureau had done on data visualization, for instance, with Marie-Eleanor Spear, who worked at the Census on labor statistics and other things. So I've always found it was a pioneering institution in the U.S. But yeah, it was great to find that information, to find that they were definitely ahead of the curve. And in 1880, they were already hiring women as professional enumerators, gathering data for the census. And also how later on in 1909, there were already 50% of their workers were, of their employees were women. So yeah, it was fascinating to see how from the actual census, as well as providing, I suppose, data for the actual suffrage to go ahead, they were employing these women, and some of them were active suffragettes. So yeah, I was very glad to find the stories of Gertrude Darden and Emily Farnham, and how they became professionals within the Census Bureau, but as I say, also managed to fight in the and join the suffrage club. Particularly, I the case of Darden, particularly interesting in that she worked as an enumerator first, but then she passed the Iowa State Bar in 1918, and then passed to do a more professional job as a lawyer, focusing on women's legal rights and joining this, what was called the Colored Women's Suffrage Club. But of course, the thing that is important to notice here is that white women achieved the women's vote in 1999 in the US with the 19th Amendment, but African American women will take much longer. It was only until 1965 that they were allowed to vote. So the role of women like Darden's was extremely important and must be celebrated. But again, Farnham, with more of a statistical background, her work as well was really commendable, and she even was appointed one of the first women as a chief of a division. So all these women from within the establishment and from within the statistics profession managed to advance and support the movement towards what we happily are able to do now, which is vote.
The other surprise for me was the state where I live and Rosemary live being mentioned so prominently.
Yes.
So Ohio is where we're located. And now I'm reading about Cuyahoga County, which is the northern part of the state where we live.
Mm-hmm.
But then reading about there's this connection between suffrage and prohibition. And that was a complete no way kind of experience for me.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting the assumptions people were making about women and why we shouldn't give women the right to vote because they will not let us do the things we want to do. I thought that was really striking in this chance piece. It stuck out to me.
Yeah, so could you flesh that out a little bit for us?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, I must say I don't know much about the state or the county, so it's difficult for me to understand whether this was a specific thing to the state or it was a thought that was more generically spread around the US. But yes, I thought this paper on the correlation between prohibition of alcohol and women's suffrage was very strange and potentially a very clear example of a spurious correlation. It's just difficult for me to assess what were the other variables that were playing into finding those correlations. But and I thought it was a real shame that the study didn't continue or it wasn't expanded to other states to see which factors were playing in there. But yeah, certainly fascinating and really crazy. But it gives an idea of how unknown women were and how these assumptions were made, as you said, without real facts or knowledge, just based on associations or mere opinions, really, very often.
Yeah, I thought it was striking that the Ohio campaigner had to come out and say, we just want you to know that the women's suffrage is not about temperance, right? Like, I thought that was like striking that they felt compelled that they had to go out and make that statement, given sort of what this had suggested.
Yeah, I can't imagine how loud this thing was being promoted. I guess it was an easy way to try and fight the suffrage movement. It was an easy way to convince people that they were a bad thing, but yeah, absolutely appalling and very fascinating fact, which would have been interested to study it more.
So, you know, in one of the articles you wrote that, and the quote was that struck me was, the suffrage movement itself was no stranger to scientific inquiry. And I was thinking about that, and I thought, wow, I wasn't thinking about what kind of data were being pulled into this and trying to continue kind of to push this forward. Could you help kind of break that down a bit?
Yes, completely. So for me, I had seen already the banners that the suffrage movement, at least in the UK, using their demonstrations, and I had seen some of the Florence Nightingale banners and the Mary Somerville. So I knew the celebrated women scientists, but what I didn't know before this research is to what extent they were involved in the science, to what extent they had this analytical minds that really drove them to look into the data and to perhaps not necessarily develop methods, but clearly critically looking at the data and assessing what was missing and what was needed and what was going to help their movement. And this was present across the movement and really materializing these union leaders. But they weren't the only ones, and it was widespread, clear, not only just a political and arts movement, but a massive scientific component to it as well that was materialized and reflected on these banners, but had a lot of work being done on economical journals, on political journals, and lots of them looking at the stats. Sadly, the RSS journals didn't necessarily reflect some of the work, but as I said, the work was being done and it was clearly analytical and quantitative in many cases.
It's really interesting because I keep thinking back to that media representation of suffragettes, right? Whether it's on Downton Abbey or there was the movie that had Meryl Streep, like, and it's always like, you know, women rushing to the streets or fighting with their families about whether they can go out and be in the marches. And sometimes engage in like physical violence to sort of fight for it. And yet there is this sort of this other story that has been so less covered about sort of all this other stuff that was happening to help propel this movement. And it's just striking to me that all of this hard work sort of gets overshadowed by the spectacle of the movement for the women's vote.
Yes, I agree. It was clearly politicized, and I don't necessarily argue that part of that more physical fight wasn't needed. There was obviously something needed to call the attention of people, but yes, I agree that this political aspect and analytical aspect and a more quieter, calmer movement was essential to it, and was the pragmatism of this movement that I will argue ultimately achieved the goal of getting the vote. So it is surprising to me as well that the more radicalized portrayal of the movement is the one that has made all the stories.
You know, you've spent in these articles this reflection on history, this thinking about where we started and where we've come to in terms of suffrage and related topics. You hinted at the idea of kind of current and future work that might be needed, in particular the idea of kind of more investigation in terms of compensation for contribution, you know, sort of equal pay investigated more deeply. What do you also see as maybe future challenges that are associated with this topic?
I guess, in general, associated with the topic of equality, diversity, and inclusion, there is, within the field of statistics, there are still clear gaps in the representation, in the celebration, and in the awards that are given. There's still a huge gap in this, making the discipline more representative. Us as statisticians will know about issues of representation and the biases they can drive to. So I guess for me, it's always the issue of representativeness, to be able to properly address the issues that the society have. We need to have the enough data, but also the specific data that is looking at the specific problems that people have. And for that, we need to understand the population as a wide thing, not just in its majority. So it's always an issue of representativeness for me, and looking at equality issues from that perspective, just being able to represent and not leaving any unknown quantities behind.
Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of Stats and Stories. Althea, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Althea.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Stats and Stories is a partnership between Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film, and the American Statistical Association. You can follow us on Twitter at Stats and Stories, Apple Podcast, or other places where you can find podcasts. If you'd like to share your thoughts on the program, send your email to statsandstories@miamioh.edu, or check us out at statsandstories.net. And be sure to listen for future editions of Stats and Stories, where we discuss the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics.